Welcome to Worlds Apart. Back in 2007, when the relations between Russia and the West were already showing signs of distress but were still manageable, Vladimir Putin remarked that after the death of Mahatma Gandhi, it's hard to find somebody to talk to and be understood. What was dismissed as a joke proved to be a prophecy. 15 years on, Russia and the West are no longer talking, and their security disputes play out as a military confrontation in and over Ukraine. Is a return to non-violence still possible, and on what conditions? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Pavan Varma, a career Indian diplomat and former member of India's permanent mission to the United Nations. Ambassador, it's great to see you, great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Ambassador, you are pretty straightforward in characterizing the Russian operation in Ukraine as a, quote, brazen attack and a contravention of international law. And I think many Russians may agree with you on that, but is there any great power or a major power in this day and age that would put abstract international law above its immediate and concrete security interests and threats to those security interests?
What we have to understand is that increasingly we are living in a multipolar world. In a multipolar world, countries which are powerful have their spheres of security influence, or what they see to be areas around them which are critical to the management of their security perceptions. Once we understand this, then we can perhaps try and understand the motivations behind Russia's unfortunate intervention in Ukraine. I say unfortunate because it has led to war. It has led to a great deal of damage and destruction. It's led to loss of lives. And it is fundamentally a transgression of a sovereign country. So to that extent, Russia stands culpable. But in diplomacy, in history, there is no black and white polarity. There are nuances. There are shades of gray. And we have to see whether today the accused are as guilty as the accuser.
Well, Ambassador, let me ask you specifically about that, because whenever I talk to American officials, they always make the case that the Russians are dangerous paranoids, that Putin lost his marbles, or that he is a psychotic megalomaniac, and that Moscow maliciously distorts the intentions and the nature of NATO. I understand that you're not a mental health professional, but whose version of reality you find to be more rooted in the facts on the ground and in the realities, in the norms of modern geopolitics?
You see, I have been a career diplomat and I have been a member of India's parliament and now involved in politics. I have a theory that we should never judge larger issues on the basis of personal demonization. You may have a perception of what Donald Trump is like. You may have a perception of what President Putin is like. But they are individuals who are trying to ensure within a given set of circumstances what is best for their national security. So I don't believe in trying, and I don't endorse and I don't accept this attempt of trying to show President Putin as some kind of megalomaniac who is beyond the pale of rational thinking. Let's get out of that debate. So we have to now see the overall circumstances, analyze them, and then try to see what the solutions can be.
Well, speaking about those overall circumstances, 5 weeks into this operation, Russia and the West still see it in starkly different terms. For the West, it's an act of unprovoked aggression with absolutely no antecedents to it. For Russia, it's a horrible, I would even say, but inevitable last resort means of protecting what it considers to be its security interest. You have the benefit of both ideological and geographical distance. Do you think those visions of reality, do you think those perceptions of the world and of security concerns, do you think they could be somehow reconciled still?
At some point, the global world balance became askew. The Berlin Wall fell. Germany reunited. In common perception, it signaled a defeat of communist Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact countries. And so the perception grew, not unfoundedly, that it has become a world in which the United States and its allies, in particular NATO, have become the real custodians of what is good for this world and what is not. And in that capacity, I think for a considerable period of time, the United States actually played out the role of the solitary global policeman. And the very rules that it wishes to apply to other nations who act in response to what they perceive to be their security interests, those rules America felt is not applicable to them. So it could with impunity go into Iraq on the basis of a suspicion that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. There was no legitimacy to that action. United States felt that as this self-proclaimed custodian of what is good for the global order that mirrors its perception of what the world should be, it can do what it wants. So Libya is bombed, Serbia is bombed, a new country, Kosovo, is created. And most importantly, the expansion of the United States and NATO, without thought of what a expansion of a military grouping means to other countries.
With all due respect, it's not like this issue rose yesterday. I mentioned what Putin said back in 2007, and already then at the Munich Security Conference and many other occasions, Russia was sounding its displeasure. It was explaining its disagreement with that strategy in pretty straightforward terms. And I understand that the Americans, whenever I had talked to them, you know, like they are very forgiving of themselves. They always sort of appeal to their best intentions, and then some mistakes could be made along the way. So they wanted what's best for Iraq, and if a million people happened to be killed because of that, well, you know, that's what happened, essentially. It's not their fault. That's the way history unfolded. But when it comes to Russia, it's not like this is something that they weren't really aware of, because Russia was very, very, very persistent in trying to bring that to their attention. Why on earth wouldn't they hear to that, even for their own sake? Because if we look at what is happening in the world, and even the American sanctions that they have to introduce, that comes back to hurt them as well. I mean, it's not so much an issue of ideology for me. I just don't understand the lack of pragmatism here.
But the essential point we have to understand is, and I think all the powers, especially in Europe, need to think about this, is that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, subsequently a new architecture of Europe on certain basic principles which respects the legitimate security and geopolitical concerns of all major powers. I don't think that was negotiated. Somewhere I think even America and NATO felt it's not necessary. And the apprehensions that Russia expressed about a unilateral expansion of the boundaries, periphery, and influence of what is the military grouping. We must understand that NATO is not some kind of democracy club. It is a military grouping which has provisions to take hostile action against anyone else which is not a part of NATO or threatens it. So, the relentless eastern expansion of NATO to the very underbelly of Russia was bound to provoke a reaction, in my view, at some point. I'm not saying this justifies the invasion of Ukraine. I'm trying to give a perspective to it. And I think America and NATO and the West in general felt that they could get away with their actions because Russia was a diminished power and would continue to accept what were obviously threats to its own perception of its sphere of influence of security. And by the way, it was not always an innocent expansion. By that I mean countries, in Ukraine there was a regime change in 2014. Now, countries are free to choose who will lead them. But there is some evidence and a theory that the West was complicit in the overthrowing of one leader of Ukraine and his replacement by someone more porous to, more amenable to, more inclined towards the West.
We have to take a very short break right now. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Они пришли меня же убивать.
Антитеррористична операція не може і не буде тривати 2-3 місяці.
Говорят, що здесь одні терористи. Які терористи? От ми терористи стоїмо.
Вижу українці, такі лощені. Я говорю, ребята, хто це розбив наш город? Говорить, це Путін. А при чому, говорю, Путін? Ведь Украина вошла в Дебальцево. Какой Путин при чем?
Банды, можно сказать. Незаконные вооруженные формирования, которым придали вид легитимности.
Мы тебя сейчас мучить будем. Ну,
это зачистка, да?
Жизни нету. Дети в подвалах сидят.
Дожились, дорожки. Божечка.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Pavan Varma, career Indian diplomat and former member of India's permanent mission to the United Nations. Ambassador, before the break, we began talking about the international system and how during certain historical moment, the Americans seem to believe that the end of history has come and that they are sort of the custodians, the forever custodians of this world. But that is clearly changing. And I think you would agree that the events in Ukraine will accelerate the speed of that change. And I think at the core of that process lies a very simple, but on the other hand, a very difficult question. And that is whether the American view of themselves as the leader or as a hegemon of the world is compatible with other countries' developmental agendas, whether other countries can be what they aspire to be, with Americans being who they insist on being. And the question is definitely not for Russia, but I wonder what would be the answer, rather, is definitely not for Russia, but I wonder what it is for a country like India. Can India be what it aspires to be with Americans holding on tightly to their self-appointed lead?
I genuinely believe that in diplomacy, dialogue helps. And I think the time has come for dialogue to make leading powers of the world understand that contrary to their illusions, the world is still and increasingly becoming a multipolar world. The United States is a powerful country. It is the world's largest democracy. The NATO is a powerful military grouping. But at the same time, you have a country like Russia, which is in its own right a powerful nation, a remarkable culture. And if I may add, because psychology is very important in the understanding of diplomacy, I think Russia is still coming to terms with the dismemberment of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So, other countries need to be careful in dealing with a country which is still very powerful, perhaps as powerful as the United States in military terms.
But Ambassador, that issue could be turned the other way around, because I totally agree with you that, especially in geopolitics, psychology is paramount. I mean, it explains pretty much everything, but you know, the acceptance of a multipolar reality, and it's not like it just appeared. It's always been like that. In a world with like some 200 countries, unilateralism is unsustainable to begin with, because everybody has their own divergent interests. But the acceptance of by the Americans of this multipolar reality also would mean the end of their vision of themselves and the end of their vision of the world. They will have to redefine who they are in this world. Do you think psychologically they can take it? Because on some level, it's very similar to what the Russians had to go through back in the 1990s, the total collapse of their own self-perception. Do you think that Americans can hopefully not take on that level of cognitive dissonance, but at least redefine themselves in the world?
In diplomacy and in the unfolding of history, at some point, reality makes an impact. If America thought that it is the sole global power of the world, Russia has asserted itself, unfortunately, by invading Ukraine, but nevertheless conveyed to the Americans that there are limits to which unilaterally you can push a singular agenda on the globe. We also have China. China is a rising power, and in the Indo-Pacific, you have a situation where the American writ is not unchallenged. Similarly, if I may say so, India is emerging as one of the world's most populous countries, fastest growing economies, a nuclear power, a vibrant and genuine democracy, and a great civilizational heritage that goes back to the dawn of time. So these are aspects that matter in terms of self-perception, of how powers and countries see themselves. China looks upon itself with its own long history as ultimately a claimant to the high table on the world. Russia had been there. India is aspiring to be the United States is seated there, but it must give room for other people to join in.
In order to give that room for other people and other countries to join it, it needs to know something about those histories that you mentioned. And I think part of the problem in the world today is that Americans are not only arrogant, but extremely ignorant of the world and its, you know, cultural heritage, its history, its the differences within its people, etc. Now, you mentioned China, and I know that in your other interview, you expressed concern that the latest developments in Ukraine and rhetorically very vocal, but kinetically very timid response of the West may embolden China into a more masculine way of defending what it defines as its national interest. How concerned you are about that, and how likely is it that China will undertake a similar action or comparable action, be it in Taiwan or in its border disputes with its neighbors?
You see, India is concerned about China. You can understand why. We are both two large Asian countries who share a disputed border, a certain recent history of conflict on the border, several wars as well. And we are concerned about an aggressive China. There have been incursions in our territory recently, and the Chinese seem to be guided by the notion that they are deserving of a degree of self-unilateralism in global diplomacy. And India has to be naturally careful about it. Now, what lessons does China draw from Ukraine? I think that China had already drawn that lesson, that the United States is not the singular global power in the world. And that lesson has been reinforced by Russia's action in Ukraine. So I don't think it will lead to excessive Chinese adventurism, because somehow it's mutually assured destruction. I mean, the world is balanced. But at the same time, China, I think, is wanting to tell the United States that we have been telling you so. Many countries in the world have been saying that the United Nations system is discredited now. It reflects the post-Second World War realities. It needs to reflect the new realities of a new global order in which there is far more acceptance of a multipolar world, and you have to negotiate the areas of influence and accommodation with each other, rather than believe that one country can decide what these should be. So we are looking for a new architecture of security today in the world.
You spent years working at the United Nations representing your country, and I'm sure you know from the inside how manipulative and ineffective that process can be, that countries, especially on the most crucial issues, they talk at one another rather than to each other. There's a lot of posturing. There's a lot of preaching. There's very little room for genuine discussion, for, you know, giving and taking. It's more about power politics and intrigue behind your back rather than, you know, coming around the table and trying to come up with a joint solution. As we are talking about the changing world order, what do you think could be created? What kind of a system could come and present that opportunity for actually, you know, joint decision-making and some sort of an open-ended dialogue, rather than the United Nations being this, you know, this place where the countries come to, you know, state that position without necessarily being engaged in diplomatic discussions?
Today, the United Nations is essentially underpinned by an undemocratic foundation. And if I may add, while Russia and the United States can occasionally be rivals, they share a condominium of being the five permanent members on the Security Council, and they share an interest in not allowing that to expand. So we have to change the architecture of the United Nations. to allow other countries who also wield considerable influence, who are the repositories of economic power, who are aspirational, to be participants in a genuine sense in real deliberations about the next phase of the kind of world order we need to build. That process will require the cooperation of the United States, but also Russia. And the second thing, if I may quickly add, is that Europe in particular today needs a dialogue where you settle the principles of the new edifice of security, which needs to be built after the fragmentation of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have only a few minutes left, and I was trying to squeeze in two questions. One about the economy, because we talked a lot about security and how it may change, in part because of Russia's actions, but the global economy is changing rapidly too, and this time because of the American response to Russia's actions, and the implications are far and large. When you look at the global commodity markets and the projections of where they may be, you know, a couple of months from now, how does it make you feel?
You see, my view is that there are two MADs, M-A-Ds. One is the mutually assured destruction of nuclear war. And there is the mutually assured deprivation of sanctions. Sanctions are not a one-way street. It's an interdependent global world. My view is that the West, being so dependent upon Russian gas and crude and other raw resources, will also feel the pinch of the sanctions. Sanctions can bite in the short run, but they are not the answer in the long run. I think that especially where crude oil is concerned, oil and gas, there will be an attempt to stabilize prices by boosting production of other oil supplier nations, especially in the Middle East, in Venezuela, in Iran, or wherever possible, to compensate for sanctions against Russia. But I think a much better resolution to economic demands is a ceasefire, a negotiated peace, and a return to dialogue on the diplomatic table.
One of the major concerns right now is the rapid growth of food prices, not only because of the Ukrainian developments, but also because of the locust swarms in Africa and the drought in North America, making the spectra of worldwide hunger much more visible. And we are not only talking about the Western populations. They have some reserves. They will not be dying of hunger. But we are talking about, you know, the population of developing countries in the South, in Africa, maybe even in Asia. Given the state of disarray in the international community, do you think it's up for that challenge right now?
No, I believe not. The world is just recovering from the COVID pandemic. Countries need a period of economic stability and access to basics, which perhaps the West has gone beyond, but the rest of the world has not. So therefore, India has always taken the stand on this issue as fairly as it was possible, that the war should end, that Russia and Ukraine should talk, and that in Europe in particular, there should be once again the resumption of dialogue which leads to an enduring peace, period of stability and prosperity. So we have maintained this and we believe in it because as a developing country, our stakes are in a stable global world economic order.
Well, Ambassador, thank you very much for your perspective, and I may add for your wisdom. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.
Thank you.